Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Kent Nurburn is the author of 16 books on spiritual values and Native American themes. He's speaking at the Black Hills Film Festival this week on the topic of race and civility as part of a panel there. His book, 1994's Neither Wolf Nor Dog, won the Minnesota Book Award for Creative Nonfiction in 1995. Now the book is a film showing at the film festival as well. And Kent Nurburn joins us from Minneapolis. Welcome to In the Moment.
I'm happy to be here, Laurie.
Do I have the number of books right? I found some conflicting information. Are you about at 16 now?
I've stopped counting, because there are so many, but because some are edited, some are written.
Right.
Yeah, 16 sounds about right. They're your literary children, and one should keep better track of the number of children they have, but we'll go with 16.
So is there a season for you, for travel, a season for writing? Are there times that you sort of plan out, and balance this life of, having that time in solitary to really do your work and that time on the road?
Well, I try to lump things together because there's nothing I love more than being on the road, in the sense of literally being on the road. Being on airplanes and going places, don't like that much. But, I'll be driving from Minneapolis out to Rapid City. That's just a joy. So what I try to do is usually in the summer or in the spring and in the fall, when it's beautiful, I like to go places and just get a rental car and cheap motels and just travel and talk and read and have a good time. Deep winter is fun sometimes just because it reminds you, that you're not in charge. So I like the deep winter trips, too.
And you have some pretty deep connections to the state of South Dakota, not only through your books, but through the Festival of Books here. You and I have actually met. I remember coming to your table, and I had my tote bag with all my books, and I said, guess which one I'm going to pull out of my bag. And we played a little game there where you were looking at me trying to figure out which book was she drawn to, and then I I had to present you with the winner. So it was, you probably don't remember that, but do you enjoy that process of meeting readers who come up to your table and are excited to see you?
Absolutely. It always amazes me, when people think that you're someone because you've written a book. I mean, to me, writing a book, I'm a worker. That's what I do. And there's an ineffable loneliness about the task of writing. It's all creating out of nothing in your imagination, and you sometimes end up feeling like when you've written something, you're sitting in a glass box and screaming as loud as you can, and you see all these faces out there, and you have no idea if anyone can hear you. And when the books finally go out, you start, the glass box is open, and the people come back. And I took it real seriously in my life that because of a letter... This is a strange little story, but when I first was in graduate school, I wrote a letter to Norman Mailer. I was incredibly miserable in graduate school, and I wrote him a letter and said, could I come and work with you? And lo and behold, he wrote me a handwritten note back saying, I don't have anyone that works with me, and there's really nothing you could do, but write more than you have been, and I'm sure that your mood has changed. But it was a very personal note. And when I got that note, from that point forward, I said, I'm always going to communicate with my readers. And if anyone wants to meet me, if they write to me, I always make a habit of writing back. And when there's a session where I get to meet people, I love it because it's person to person. And it takes away that kind of abstract distance that comes from being a writer and knowing that they all know you, but you don't know who they are. And suddenly you can put names to faces and faces to names. So, I love that event. Those are great.
So when we talk about the... Go ahead.
I'm just going to say in passing that the South Dakota Festival of the Book is one of my favorite. It's such a gem. It's so intimate, and such good people come to it. And everyone that goes there, and if you're any of you in South Dakota that have never gone to it, go. It's just a wonderful time for everybody. I always look forward to that.
Well said. So let's talk about that. You mentioned the loneliness as I read Neither Wolf Nor Dog. There's that sense of worthiness as you struggle with, you know, in the book as the narrator trying to figure out, you know, how to tell this story, how to tell it well. There's issues of humility and shame because of the subject matter and history. As a writer who has spent a career really digging into issues of, you know, Native American spirituality, human spirituality, American spirituality, do you ever get over that sense of loneliness and that search for a sense of worthiness?
No, I never get over it because it's just in my nature. I tend to be a watcher and a listener. And the more you watch and the more you listen in this world, the more you see that we've got, most people are just ordinary people slogging through life trying to be kind. And yet we have these divisions amongst us and between us of culture, of personality, and to me, breaking down that barrier is my task as a writer, seeing through multiple eyes. But I never get over that feeling that I'm one of the privileged ones. When I'm working on Native subjects, we as the non-Native people are we're the occupying people. And to me, it's absolutely essential that we approach the Native experience with humility, that we don't get trapped into sociological assessments of the current Native reality if we as the dominant culture don't like what we see. Instead, we have to look with humility and listen to the deep knowledge that they have and the deep knowledge that often is hidden under certain sort of cultural devastation. But to me, I approach always with humility, and I assume I'm a guest on their land, and I wait until, I stand at the door and wait until someone says, come on in. But I'll never force myself in just because I don't think that's my place, and I think that's the proper tone of respect that we need to take.
How much patience has that taken for you as a writer?
As a writer, just as a human being, I think patience is absolutely important in dealing with any other culture. You have to become a listener. I mean, I remember Wilma Mankiller, who was the head of the Cherokee, hearing her speak one time, and she said, white people, and you could try to make any non-Native person, but especially white people, have such an incredible sense of privilege. They think that because they have good intentions, they can go anywhere, do anything, and ask anything. And that really struck me. So to me, I think that you need to constantly be aware that someone is giving you a gift of their knowledge. We sort of run roughshod over the continent because we won in terms of the physical battles and in some ways the cultural battles. So the only way we can really learn is to sit back, keep our mouths shut, and listen. And that requires patience. It requires not filling up all the empty spaces in conversations, not presuming that our knowledge base is something to measure against someone else's knowledge base, but simply being present, sitting quietly and listening. And so I look at patience as it's a tool and as well as a virtue. And I think we can all benefit from it. And as a writer, I find that patience and humility are two things that I think you have to try to cultivate at all times. And so they're the tools of my trade. Mm.
There's a point in the book where the word forgiveness plays pretty heavily, and this is a moment where you're really seeking forgiveness for, history, for the past. Is that possible to sort of ask for forgiveness? What happens after that moment for you?
Let me generalize it a bit. We as a Native, or as a country, at least have to offer an apology. And if, to the extent that an apology is asking for forgiveness, I think this is absolutely essential. I've never met a Native person who didn't, no matter whether they were people deep on the reservation or someone fairly acculturated living in cities, who didn't have the basic position that we just wish someone would say they were sorry. And I feel that in my heart. We need to have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We need to have a public acknowledgement that we screwed up. we maybe did it with a good heart. Maybe there was no ill intention in this, but we damaged a people when we came. We're a group of people when we came to this country, in this continent. So, the search for an apology, the desire to get forgiveness, is more a desire on my part to say that I feel responsible. That's one of the lines that Dan once used in the book. I don't care if you feel guilty, because feeling guilty is just another way of feeling good about yourself, he said. I care that you take responsibility, because though you didn't cause any of this, and this is always the argument you hear, you know, I didn't do anything to anyone. I treat everyone the same. Well, the fact is we're drinking the water downstream from events that took place, and at least we have to acknowledge that. And so I might have, you know, when I wrote the book, forgiveness might have been a stronger theme in my mind. And now that I've worked for a number of years, it's more quiet acknowledgement of some wrongs that cannot necessarily be righted, but have to be acknowledged and given their fair due in our understanding of each other and the way that we interact with each other.
As you look, and if you're just tuning in, this is In the Moment, my guest, Dr. Kent Nerburn, author of Neither Wolf Nor Dog and numerous other books. We're focusing on Neither Wolf Nor Dog today because of the Black Hills Film Festival and the film adaptation, which is being shown in Hill City this weekend. And Kent, I'm wondering, you know, as we talk about truth and reconciliation, clearly there's still a divide in South Dakota between Native and non-Natives. What do you think is causing that today? Is it just that drinking downstream, or are there things that are happening now that are contributing to that? And where do we move forward?
Well, you know, the big and impossible questions, but necessary ones. I think one of the things that always shows up is intimacy. When we have an intimate relationship with another group of people, you tend to see, on one level, you feel like, I know them better than these people on the outside telling me how it is that we should be. And so those on the outside telling the South Dakotans how the race relation should go can be dismissed because they don't have that intimate day-to-day rubbing of shoulders. But the other thing is we tend to look through the lens of our own cultural point of view. And my experience with South Dakota has been, because it's such a big, empty state in terms of, you know, physical population, people can sort of disappear into their own little worlds. You know, you've got Rapid, and you've got Chamberlain and Pierre, and then you've got Sioux Falls. But other than that, it's this big space where the land speaks a different language than the culture speaks. And we need to find a way to listen to what the other people, the other groups have to say. I mean, the history is so, it's so immediately apparent on the land. It's this history of the natives and non-natives, the great reservation that was supposed to be and then got carved up the way that the Pa'asapa has been commercialized. And I think that for the non-native culture, the white culture to survive, it has to acknowledge, it literally has to take advantage of the dominance that it established in terms of taking over the land for ranching, for farming, for commercial purposes. But if you acknowledge that, then if you don't acknowledge that, you're giving up what you have. But if you do acknowledge it, you have a difficult time making peace with the other groups that you dominated in order to get there. So I just think that it's a long-standing problem. And then you have that difference of looking, that whole thing with the water rights and with the pipeline. I mean, it's economy versus the land. And those are two different paradigms. And they're both real, they're both essential, but they're definitely different paradigms, and people don't tend to see through the same eyes.
Is there an opportunity in that, in a conversation that is, sparking around something like a pipeline? Because as I did those, you know, interviews, you know, talking about what was happening in North Dakota, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of room for compromise or understanding. I didn't see the conversation moving forward a lot. Is it an opportunity or is it just a flashpoint?
Well, I think it's an opportunity. I mean, I have my own very definite points of view that there's a great naivete in assuming that we can master nature and protect against such things as the disasters that could come from a pipeline like that. So that's my own personal bias. But I think South Dakota and North Dakota there with the pipeline can really be a proving grounds, because it's the first time I've heard the voice of the Native people being heard as a dominant voice in a cultural conversation. I remember listening to CNN one day, and this woman, one of their commentators had been sent out to the pipeline site, and she came back just amazed. She said, "Well, look at they pray in the morning, and they're very peaceful in their way of doing things." And I thought to myself, well, of course, the Native people are in charge of this. And did it always stay peaceful? No. Was it always easy? No. But the Native people claimed the opposition, and they were able to do it in the way that they wanted it done. And I think that by getting their voice heard, even though there are arguments within the tribes about what the right course of action is, the Native voice got heard for the first time, perhaps since Wounded Knee. In the 70s. And so I think that there is a chance for South Dakota and North Dakota and essentially the Native and non-Native communities to make their confrontation and their conversation into part of the national dialogue. And I mean, I lived in Minnesota for many years, and that was flyover country, but nothing compared to the Dakotas. It's just, nobody looks down. The media never goes anywhere and never leaves the freeway unless there's an explosion. And so when there's a chance for a dialogue and a chance for a conversation, and the light is shining on this very interesting dynamic where the land still dominates over the culture and the history is right on the surface, I think that it's a rare opportunity. But people need to talk to each other, and I think right now we've got to get past that initial anger and the political reality of it, and then start the conversation again. How that's done, hopefully things like the book, like Neither Wolf Nor Dog, will help start that conversation. And can I say one more short thing, or do you need a break here?
Can we take one thought, and then we'll take a quick break and bring you back.
Right. Years ago, a man contacted me who was he was involved with the Missouri River for the BLM or something, and he actually was able to change some of the course of one of their irrigation projects off the Missouri because of what he'd read in Neither Wolf Nor Dog. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was one of those things that said, this book has done some good. The book is a dialogue, and that's why I think I care about this book greatly, because it is a dialogue, and I think people that read it start to understand the dialogue a little more. But we can talk more about that after our break.
So. Yeah, we're going to take a quick break here. My guest is Dr. Kent Nerburn, author of Neither Wolf Nor Dog. Stay in the moment, SDPB Radio. And welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. My guest today, Kent Nerburn. He's the author of Neither Wolf Nor Dog and many other books. We're talking to him today before his appearance at the Black Hills Film Festival. This week, he's going to sit on a panel and discuss the topic of race and civility. There'll be a screening of the movie Neither Wolf Nor Dog, adapted from the book. And Dr. Nerburn, we were just talking about really the impact of a book like this and that it can have. People are coming to it for the first time, maybe, if they haven't read it before now when they hear a movie is coming out. Other stories of what happens next when you release a book like this into the world?
Well, let me back up one step, because I thought of something during the break that I wanted to say about why this book has, been so successful over so many years. You never know when you write it exactly what you have. But this book has proven its worth all around the world in teaching situations, because of what it does is it lets you see through two different sets of eyes. It was a real dilemma to know how to write a book that would give the Native point of view. At the same time, it kept my own white or Euro-American point of view. And right. So by keeping myself as the narrator, we could have a dialogue. There's one chapter in there where I actually talk about I mentioned this because it's relevant to your area, where Dan and Grover and I are going through the Badlands and aiming towards the Black Hills. And I talk about how the Black Hills are how when I was a child, and we would get in our car and drive from Minneapolis in the sweltering heat and go through interior, and I was waiting for, you know, waiting to get to the pony rides and the big stone faces on the mountains and the reptile gardens and that was how I saw it, and it was a wonderful time in my life. But as I did the travels for the book, instead I started to see through native eyes and saw what had happened to this land and the power of the land as a spiritual force. And by having these two points of view in the book, it doesn't give precedence to one over the other. It doesn't say that this one's right and this one's wrong. It says we're just people that see through different sets of eyes. And so I wanted people to come to that book not defensively, either as natives feeling that they're being exploited or as non-natives who feel like, well, no, it's just one more book about beating up on us for what we've done here in America. That isn't it. It's we're all good people struggling to get by. Mm-hmm. And I try to show in that book and in the two subsequent books in the series, Wolf of Twilight and The Girl Was Saying to the Buffalo, different ways of seeing the same reality. And I'm very happy that it's been successful in doing that. And I think that does move towards dialogue in some way.
Was it important to you as well to really keep in this sort of emotional trajectory of the narrator in this book, saying, you know, sometimes it just feels like these men are messing with you or, you know, teasing you or punishing you, or there's a white perspective there that gets frustrated, gets angry, wants to sort of run away from this. How important was it for you to sort of keep all that, you know, the guts of it and the grittiness of it and the imperfection of everyone's character intact throughout the book?
Boy, you hit it hit the nail on the head there, the imperfection of everyone's character. In the book, there is a scene where Winona confronts me after I'm just frustrated, mm-hmm. saying I didn't ride with Custer, I didn't give anyone any smallpox blankets, I didn't do any of this. And she comes back at me very hard. I stand up for myself, and the white readers read that and say, yeah, finally, this guy, he's finally standing up for himself. I thought that was my weakest moment, because mm-hmm. if indeed I have to be the target for personal or cultural anger, I'm happy to take it. But I think that, but at the same time, I'm not going to give up the fact that when I drive through the reservations and see a bunch of junk cars, I see a bunch of junk cars. So we go back and forth in this kind of fiery dialogue about what it is that we're all confronting. And yes, I bring my flaws to it. Dan brings some real deep personal cultural anger to it. Grover really carries forth as having a warrior's mentality. And every time I try to get a little bit step out of place, I get knocked down. I get knocked back, and it hurts. I get angry. At the same time, I will push on them, because the essence of the writing experience for this, for me, was because of all my, this is not me making up stuff, mm-hmm. some white man making up stuff about India. This is me from all my living and working on the reservations and working with the various Native people. These are all real emotions that were either sent towards me or that I had in response to situations. That was the measure. I mean, white readers will look at it through one set of eyes, but the Indian readers always have a very, very incredibly sensitive barometer for white garbage, for people, for white people overspeaking. I'd use a different word, but where, you know, you probably get bleeped out. But their barometer is absolutely impeccable. And if I misspoke or had my emotional state wrong, I get called on. You still there? Oh,
yeah.
And there's, you know, and the white people have challenged this book on occasion, but I have never yet had a Native person come up to me and say, you know, you got it wrong. Mm-hmm. They all say, thank you for doing this. And they pass it around in prisons. They've used it in all the reservations. And mm-hmm. so I hit the emotional temperature right on that.
Kent Nerburn, our time is short. The book is Neither Wolf Nor Dog. The film is showing at the Black Hills Film Festival this weekend in Hill City and in Rapid City. Kent Nerburn will be there for a conversation on race and civility. Please come back anytime. We will talk to you whenever you're available. Thanks for your time today.
Well,
Kent.
I've got new stuff to talk about. I'll be happy to come back, and I appreciate South Dakota. I love the place. So
it's a deal.
We'll be with you.